American politics may never be the same. On To The Point, we help you understand the trends driving this wild and woolly election.
Donald Trump has had nothing but wonderful things to say about all variety of dictators and thugs around the world.
Our system of politics right now is so incredibly corrupt.
The sense of nostalgia for a kind of lost cultural world and real anxiety about its passing, I think, is fueling, you know, much of what we're seeing.
I'm Armin Alney. Stay with To The Point through November and beyond on KCRW and KCRW.com.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
This is the last Left, Right, and Center before the election. Gut check time. Who's going to win? And after James Comey's letter last Friday, the FBI has been leaking like something leakier than a sieve. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who directed the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama. He's also been advising Hillary Clinton. Our special guest is Margie Omero, a Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research. Welcome, everybody. So there's been the tightening and the bedwetting. Polls moved sharply against Hillary Clinton in the last week and a half. The poll movement actually started before James Comey announced last Friday that the FBI was looking at new emails, possibly related to Hillary Clinton, on a laptop used by Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin. Since then, the 538 model has moved to show Donald Trump with about a 30% chance of winning the presidency. Financial indicators, including the dollar-peso exchange rate, have also started to indicate an increased chance of a Trump victory. In this environment of rising nervousness, we've been hearing all sorts of secondhand stories of internal campaign polls showing the race close or not close in various places, and we have read tea leaves. Why is Hillary campaigning in Detroit on Friday? Is Michigan closer than either side thought it was? Early voting has been up this year in many states. What does that mean that final turnout is likely to look like? So, Margie, I want to start with you. With all that information around us, can you summarize where you believe this race is right now?
Well, so there are a couple different theories. I mean, clearly the polls overall have tightened. If you're looking at the polling averages nationally and in the states, you see tightening. You see, you know, evidence of people thinking that there's a tighter race because you see the campaigns spending more time on expanding the board, whether that means Michigan or Wisconsin or Arizona or Georgia. There's Colorado, which is a state that was considered put away. You see the campaigns now really moving into this broader list as opposed to narrowing the list of battleground states. That said, there's also a theory that the polling that's tightening reflects actually a response rate effect, that voters who are less engaged and enthusiastic that day because their candidate is getting a, you know, having a rough day in the news, are less likely to pick up the phone, less likely to answer a poll. And that's what's driving fluctuation in some of these polls. We don't actually know the answer. We'll see as these things evolve and we'll see what happens on election day. But overall, for sure, it looks like a tighter race than we had 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, this has been this big debate between pollsters. A lot of people have been watching the ABC News Washington Post tracking poll, which debuted a couple of weeks ago with Hillary Clinton up 12 and then fairly quickly collapsed to show Hillary Clinton behind by one. Today it has her up 3. At the same time, you have other polls, for example, by YouGov, which is a British pollster that uses a large panel of people that they survey repeatedly. And that poll has been almost eerily flat through the election, showing Hillary ahead by approximately 4 points for more or less the last year. And YouGov wrote this explanation basically talking about exactly what you're talking about there, Margie, where they see on days when news is bad for Hillary Clinton, it's harder to get Hillary supporters to respond to the survey, and they adjust their results for that. And I guess my question for you is, you have these two theories. One is that you ask people whether they're eager and you call them on the phone and see if they answer, and that that's an indicator of turnout and it shows this very variable race like ABC has. Or you assume that whether or not people are eager to talk on the phone today, that doesn't affect that much their likelihood to vote. You sort of bet that the electorate will look a lot like the electorate 4 years ago, and then you get the answer like YouGov that the race is very stable. And I guess the question is there any way to try to figure out which of those two theories is right?
I mean, it's tough to know that without actually having the data set. I mean, that's one thing. We're sort of going on the data that comes filtered and weighted and polished and shined and then arrives to us. The other thing to remember is that, you know, we're trying to measure an electorate, a universe that doesn't exist yet. You know, people are saying whether or not they're going to vote, whether or not they have voted. And at some level, you know, they're doing the best job they can to report whether or not they're going to vote. They don't actually know that. You know, we don't know if they're going to get sick or if they're going to get caught in traffic or if they're going to have an emergency at work or at home. So we are just doing the best we can. I say we, kind of the industry collectively, to predict that final universe. And it's not that pollsters are getting it wrong. It's just that it does not actually exist yet. We have imperfect information to try to figure out what that is. We're just so desperate to have the answer in advance that people are trying to figure out if it's right or it's wrong. And I don't think we know yet whether or not it's right or wrong.
So, Gene, given all that, are you nervous?
Sure, I'm nervous. I'm nervous in the sense that I've never had an election I've been involved in where I really thought that if the Republican opponent won, that it would be extremely harmful to the country. I mean, I worried about the Supreme Court composition. I worried about fiscal policy, tax progressivity. But I think a lot of the anxiety you feel from people is more around that they feel it is a more terrible result. And they worry about Donald Trump as the kind of moral leader of the country. They worry about him as a person who has the temperament to run national security and to not do, you know, off-the-cuff things that could lead us to, you know, war. So I think that's a lot of it. But I think that, you know, and some of this is psychology, right? It's a little bit like, how do people deal with this degree of uncertainty that reflects their optimism or pessimism? But I do feel there's kind of two or three camps out there, and it does depend what camp you put them in. One is that this has been trending against Hillary Clinton, and that feeling is that it's drip, 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 and boy, by the time it gets to election day, it's going to really be scary. The other is, she took a hit over the weekend with the Comey revelation, the brutally unfair Comey revelation, and that she is now stabilized. And she's stabilizing not at +6 like she was before, but she's still stabilizing at +3. And that until you see a serious threat to her firewall, which is really Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Colorado at this point, you know, she still looks very positive, particularly because she certainly seems to be very much in play, toss up at least in North Carolina or Florida. And of course, as long as she has a chance in Florida, a lot of things can go wrong if you win Florida. So I have to say that at this moment, I would say the stabilization theory seems a little more likely Friday morning, but that would put me in a more, you know, that gives you a little bit of optimism. But, you know, all you have to do is see one or two polls that go against your theory to start feeling the tightness in your stomach again.
Rich, clearly one of the things that's happening with Trump getting closer is Republicans coming home. And this has been obviously a very tough election season internally in the Republican Party. A lot of writers and intellectuals in the party, including yourself, have been very resistant to Donald Trump. Are you surprised at the level of consolidation that he seems to be achieving among Republican voters?
No, I thought he'd mostly get to the same level of partisan support as Hillary Clinton. Now, the Access Hollywood tape and the entire terrible month with the debates and all that really suppressed his support among Republicans, but I'm not shocked that it's snapped back. And Gene puts his finger on just the major issue here. The last couple of days, it seemed as though it's a 2 or 3 point race nationally, and the question is, does it stay there? Does Clinton stabilize at that number? Does she bounce back up? Or are we looking at a secular trend going all the way into Election Day? But certainly, in the state polling we've seen the last couple of days, there is a plausible path to 270 for Donald Trump. If he holds all the Romney states, which includes North Carolina, which might be the weakest link in that scenario, and wins Iowa, where he's been very strong, Ohio, where he's still looking good, and Florida, where Hillary's a little bit ahead in the latest polls, but it's going to be very close regardless, and wins the main second congressional district, which seems a pretty good chance, he's at 260. And then it's just a question of where he can get these 10 other electoral votes. And he could get them from Nevada and New Hampshire. He's been behind in New Hampshire pretty much since the entire convention in early fall. Now polls show it pretty close. There's one poll that had him ahead in Nevada, maybe an outlier. And these other states where if he doesn't get those, he would have to go, you know, a Pennsylvania and a Michigan are looking much closer. So this thing is really close and could get closer yet.
So, Margie, let me turn to you on that then, with what Rich was describing and the path that Donald Trump would have to walk in order to get into the White House through North Carolina, Nevada, Florida, that congressional district in Maine, New Hampshire. How plausible is it that he can run the table and win that set of states, which would give him the White House?
I mean, it's certainly plausible, right? Now, Democrats take some comfort in the fact that that Clinton has an incredible advantage in terms of the ground game, in terms of the efficiency that she's been building now for a long, long time. We did a poll at my firm where we asked people what kind of voter contact they could recall over 10 different types of contact, web videos or mail or TV ads. And she did a far better job of having contact with her base that they recalled than Trump did with his. And that was very much consistent. The main advantage that Trump had over her is in swag. He was the swag king. He was, you know, people in every demographic group, he crushed her at having people recall lawn signs and stickers, which,
right,
you know,
by swag, and, you mean things like hats, not hats. Not his
yes.
personal demeanor.
You're right. On swagger.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's consistent with all the reporting we've seen about what he prioritizes. And that's not the same as, you know, having a team of people that goes out and brings people to the polls.
Regarding the polls co-varying, which is to say that if Hillary underperforms her polls in Pennsylvania, she'll probably do that everywhere else. That's usually the case with elections. I'm wondering if that could be different this year because of some of the demographic weirdnesses that we've been seeing. For example, we're seeing some signs that Hispanic turnout is very strong in the early vote. We're also seeing some signs that Black turnout may be weak in certain places in the early vote. So if that were happening and that were a reason that the polls were off, you would actually see quite different effects in different states. You might see Hillary underperform in Pennsylvania and Ohio, but then you could see her overperform in places like Nevada and Florida. And I'm wondering, Margie, is that something that can actually give Clinton supporters a little bit of comfort that there's some counterbalancing in the map in that regard?
You know, sure. I mean, Trump has alienated all kinds of different groups that he needs and, you know, in favor of consolidating one basic group and, you know, that of white, non-college educated men, which are not enough to make, you know, to get you over the edge. You need to be able to win over people from other demographics. And so I think the last point that I'll say in terms of polling, I think it's difficult in a poll of 600 interviews in a state to, you know, really be able to capture some of the fine tuning that we're talking about here in terms of turnout. And we're relying on a variety of different outlets. You know, I think sometimes we are hoping to have a level of precision that the polls are not necessarily designed to do.
But we want to know now.
Well, Josh, I think that if you were looking among Democrats on level of nervousness, the, you know, some of those who are feeling a bit better are those who are most focused on the early vote ground game, particularly, as you say, among Latino voters. And, you know, I think President Obama really helped with this. He saw this anxiety among Democrats, and he started with the don't boo vote. Well, I think that's kind of translated into if you're sitting around with a nervous stomach, go to Nevada, go to Arizona, go to Florida, go to North Carolina, and be part of getting the early vote. And there does seem to be both a very strong ground game and there are numbers that show a higher, particularly Latino early vote turnout in these critical states. And so you start hearing people talking a little bit of a firewall, that in some of these states, if this continues and this level of enthusiasm continues and more people, show up in those states to help, you know, get out the vote, that you'll go into that election day with a bit of an early vote cushion. Maybe not, that's not a guarantee, but that is where you see a bit more optimism at times on the Democratic side.
I'm skeptical. I've always been skeptical of the idea that there are these shy Tory Trump voters. But to Margie's point, we don't know exactly what the turnout is going to be. And it's not outside of the realm of imagination. We haven't seen it in voter registration numbers, but it's still not outside the realm that Trump could change the electorate by turning out working class whites at higher rates than we've seen in a very long time. And Josh, you're right. There are demographic wrinkles state to state. But so far, we've seen the states pretty well line up with the national numbers. You know, when it was a 6-point race, Hillary was ahead 7 or 8 points in Pennsylvania and Michigan. You know, now it's about a 2 or 3-point race. And, you know, she has a two or four point lead in Pennsylvania, and maybe something comparable in Michigan. So
well,
if it's.
I can test that in two places, actually. Her Florida numbers have held up much better than her Ohio numbers. About 6 weeks ago, it looked like they were doing about the same in each of those states. And the other thing is Arizona's been weird. Arizona, we got a poll just a couple of days ago that had Hillary Clinton up 1, and the Clinton campaign has been investing a lot of time and energy and money into Arizona. Now, maybe they're wasting it, but it suggests to me that they think these heavily Hispanic places are actually playing out differently than the rest of the map and that there is this asymmetric thing.
Yeah, although we've also had two polls that have Trump up 5 in Arizona. But we'll have to see. We will have to wait, you know, 5 days. But it could be that you see Trump, you know, win Iowa handily, you know, which has been a state on the razor edge in recent elections, and win Ohio and perform much better in places like Michigan, even if he doesn't win it, and then really lose the election in these states with higher percentage of Latino voters, Nevada, Colorado, perhaps Arizona. I'm a little skeptical of that, but certainly Florida. I mean, Florida, we say this every 4 years, is an enormous deal. And obviously, if Hillary wins there, it's a kill shot.
Well, let us know what you think about the map at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, we'll talk about James Comey. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who has advised Presidents Clinton and Obama and candidate Hillary Clinton on economic matters. Margie Omero, Democratic pollster and executive vice president at PSB Research, is also with us. So last Friday, James Comey's letter shook up the race, but even more amazing has been the parade of leaks and counter-leaks out of the FBI, disclosing inquiries of sorts into former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort and his financial links to pro-Russian forces in Ukraine, and also into finances in the Clinton Foundation. These leaks have been confusing and often contradictory. Fox News' Brett Baer had to retract a report that the FBI would likely proceed toward an indictment of Hillary Clinton after the election. And they seem to indicate something of a civil war inside the FBI between agents who would like to settle internal scores or scores against other agencies or tip the election in one direction or the other. I think there are two separate questions here. One about whether Jim Comey himself has behaved appropriately, going back to the recommendation not to seek an indictment in July and the press conference that he gave pretty spectacularly criticizing Hillary Clinton over her handling of classified material, and then his decision to release this letter this week. And then there's a second question about the FBI more broadly and why it's leaking so much and whether it's a dysfunctional organization, even if Jim Comey, we might say, is doing his best to hold it together. So I want to start with you, Rich. You wrote a column more or less in defense of Jim Comey this week. What's the case for the way he's handled this?
Well, I'm a modified James Comey defender. I think the case you can make is that he never should have said anything. He just should have made his recommendation to the Justice Department in July and left it at that. But there was so much political interest in this case, he felt, to create more legitimacy around his decision, that he had to explain it. And that's when he gets to the slippery slope that leads to what happened last Friday. And he testifies before Congress. He says this matter is closed, and everyone who's voting in this election is under that impression. Then, through really no fault of his own, the FBI comes into possession of material. That means this matter is not closed, and it's going to be reopened. So does he mislead the public by just letting that go and not informing anyone of it, or does he let us all know. He chose to let us all know. I think, you know, it's a hard choice. You can argue it either way. But the idea that we've seen this makes him like the equivalent of J. Edgar Hoover, or he's a threat to democracy, or all the rest of it, is completely absurd, especially coming from people who literally, you know, 8 days ago were arguing from authority from James Comey, saying, you know, James Comey thinks no reasonable prosecutor would bring this case, so the matter is just closed and there's really no dissent over the matter.
Gene, I guess the reason that I, to some extent, feel for Comey here is that basically it's not supposed to be the FBI's job to decide who to prosecute. They refer information to the Justice Department, which makes decisions. And there was this decision in the Justice Department that they would say that they were going to honor whatever recommendation Comey brought to them, which was a decision made because if the Obama DOJ made the decision about whether to indict, people would accuse them of having made a political decision. So they sort of put in Comey's lap the political responsibility for this decision that, regardless of the merits, and I think Comey made a good case that there were no merits for an indictment, that basically Comey was going to be in the position of being blamed for whatever happens. So isn't his need to both defend his decision and to defend his institutional prerogatives, doesn't it make the July press conference and the letter this week or letter last week actually make some amount of sense?
I can almost agree half with that. I am in the camp of people who feel that it was a clear decision not to prosecute and that he did not need to do that exceptional and unprecedented press conference. But I understand the logic of it. I disagree with it, but I think it's something honorable people can disagree on. There is no defense, none, for releasing that, for putting out that letter 10 days before a presidential election. And I've been struck by the amount of even very significant Hillary Clinton critics, very conservative Republicans, who have also felt that way. And why? Because anyone can understand this. With 10 days left to go, you put out a smear, a cloud of doubt with the government auspices of the FBI over any human being in a context where they have no capacity to truly respond. Remember, if this happens in September, you've got three debates to go forward with it. And the idea that that decision, which could, based on things that could be proved to be absolutely meaningless, could actually shift a presidential election, will go down as one of the more shameful government decisions and certainly FBI decisions, I think, in their history.
Margie, what have you made of the aftermath this week with all of the anonymously sourced stories out of the FBI that we've seen, some of them in defense of Hillary Clinton, I would say the preponderance of them sort of negative for her? On November 9th, how does the FBI pick up the pieces, and how can people in either political party trust the FBI as a neutral arbiter that enforces laws, given how political its involvement in this election has ended up being?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just part of the overall coarsening of all of our dialogue and our lack of institutions, and it's unfortunate. I mean, the polling showed, thankfully, that it didn't seem to have an immediate impact, right? So you had Morning Consult, SurveyMonkey did polling before and after the Comey letter, and they didn't see any impact. And in self-report, as well as in actual trend and where the vote went, self-report impact, people would just view it through their own partisan lenses only, which I guess is not surprising. But I think in the end, though, I think you can make a good case that this has led to some of the tightening that's happened over the week as the story continued to be in the news. And it's just leading to all these additional questions about the security and professionalism of the Trump team. To, you know, I think Giuliani said, was it today? Said, yes, I've been hearing stuff from the FBI and I'm angry about it. So, I mean, there's a sense that there's simply no standard anymore. There's no minimum standard of what's acceptable behavior anymore. Anything is fair game. That's when the Donald Trump campaign has shown us, and by extension, that's true now, you know, across all government institutions in a way that I think is going to leave people feeling terrible about our government, no matter what the outcome is in November 8th.
I got a dissent from a couple things. One, Gene's language of Comey making accusations. He didn't make accusations. He just said we came into possession of this additional material that we have to review. And two, I mean, it's a very important norm prior to this point not to nominate for president someone who is under an FBI investigation. And if it had been a normal Democratic race with a bunch of viable candidates, that probably would have and should have killed Hillary Clinton. But once you have someone who's on the cusp of the presidency, who's under a serious FBI investigation, it's going to be very hard for that to end well, and not for both sides to feel they're ill-used no matter what happens. So that was the norm that the Democrats violated. We've talked a lot about the norms Republicans violated in nominating Donald Trump, but that's the one Democrats violated, and it's part because they put their head in their sand from the beginning about the seriousness of this email investigation and also about the corrupt practices around the Clinton Foundation. And this will extend into a Clinton administration if she's elected, and we're going to have a crisis over the FBI, where, you know, is James Comey's position sustainable if Hillary Clinton is elected president, or will he resign? And if he does, she's going to, you know, start out with what's going to play like sort of a Saturday Night Massacre event right at the outset.
But Rich, the thing is, you know, regardless of the merits of her as a nominee, when you have the situation where you have people who are not Comey, who are lower in the FBI, who are frustrated that she became the nominee or that she wasn't indicted or that the information about the investigations was not publicly released, when you get them just calling up all the reporters they know and telling them what the FBI is up to, even whether or not Comey stays as director, doesn't that indicate a significant problem that's going to need to be addressed in some way at the FBI?
Well, I mean, the reason why they feel aggrieved is they think the DOJ has squashed this investigation.
But and so we what?
We don't know. And it's not as though the DOJ is not leaking as well. We have leaks going on both sides. Again, so when you have an investigation with such extremely high political stakes, human nature being what it is, it's hard to see something like this not happening. So one, don't do the private server to begin with, and don't nominate someone with this vulnerability.
We've sure. reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Gene Sperling, what's your rant?
My rant is with longtime Republican Congressman Scott Garrett, who said he would not support or contribute to the Republicans if they continued to promote gay candidates. He faces a high-talent opposition in Josh Gottheimer in the 5th District of New Jersey, and there's a lot of people who would like to see him take a loss to send a very important signal on that type of anti-gay statement.
Margie O'Meara.
So this election has incredible consequences, not just in how we're seen around the world, but important policies that matter, taxes, health care, investment, but also how our children see ourselves. And so there's a new poll by the New York Times and Pollfish that shows that nearly half of teenage girls say Donald Trump's comments about women have affected how they think about their bodies. So in this election, which I hoped we would be talking about inspiring young women, we spent more time talking about the proper size for a Miss Universe or the definition of consent. So I hope from a week from now, we're going to see more women in office. We're going to be talking about the excitement and relief about having a woman president. And it's a gift we should want for all of our children.
Rich Lowry.
I'm a baseball fan, but not a hidebound baseball traditionalist, so I was delighted to see managers this postseason break from the stupid practice of using a team's best relievers only in the eighth or ninth inning. I hope it's the first step towards more thoroughgoing baseball reform, including a pitch clock, a ban on visits to the mound, and laser strike zones. You heard it here first.
Why do you hate America, Rich? So for my rant, this election's been traumatic for the country, and I've talked about that before, and I'm worried that our politics is going to continue to be traumatic, even if Hillary Clinton wins the election. I think certainly we will have a traumatic politics. God forbid should there be a President Donald Trump, but there was a poll that I believe it was the ABC poll that asked people whether they believe that either presidential candidate can bring the country together after the election. And even a quarter of Democrats believe that Hillary Clinton will be unable to bring the country together after the election. There are good reasons to fear that the fissures in our politics have become permanent. And it's very sad. And I don't have really any idea what to do about it. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Gene Sperling, and Margie O'Meara. Laura Dinemillion produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC.
Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.